Welcome to Bankless, where we explore the frontier of internet money and internet finance. This is how to get started, how to get better, and how to front run the opportunity. This is Ryan Sean Adams. I'm here with David Hoffman, and we're here to help you become more bankless. David, I felt like this was a masterclass in Web3, a masterclass in crypto. We had Chris Dixon on the podcast. We went through five mental models that are essential listening material, essential understanding, I think, if you're on the crypto journey and you're trying to understand everything that's going on in this new era of transformation. What were some of your thoughts and takeaways from this episode?
I particularly enjoyed how all these mental models bled into one, and you can definitely hear Chris's stream of consciousness, his train of thought as to how he came about these mental models. And each one of these mental models is both a tweet thread and also a post on Chris's website, so you can follow along on his website as well if you want to do that. And we go through just the gamut of why Web3 actually gets the designation of three, the primitives behind the establishment of Web3 tokens as a digital primitive, as a digital version of a new website. Also, the difference between what Chris calls the take rate, or basically the fees that platforms charge, and how the lowering of a take rate in Web3 turns from revenue into economies, and extrapolation on that. And then, of course, the famous all innovations start out as a toy, and how the early blockchain just mimics the same sort of early innovations that we've seen across other investment paradigms that we've seen in the past. And so really just a comprehensive lesson on both what is Web3, why is it valuable, and also how to invest as well.
Yeah, it really covered everything. And Chris is like, he knows what he's doing in this space, and like he knows what he's doing when it comes to venture. And he's seen so many of these patterns play out before. And now he's like applying these patterns to crypto. I got to say, there are different lenses through which you can view crypto. You know, one popular lens is some people only see crypto as sort of a money solution, right? Kind of the money lens of crypto. Others think about, like, you know, the bankless, you know, like DeFi sort of movement. Others think that this is a Web3 big disruption to tech incumbents. You know, still others think about the metaverse. I think, like, we probably view it as all of those things simultaneously at once. And I do think that the term Web3 has increasingly had validation over the past year or so. I think some people were jaded, myself included, were a little bit jaded with the term coming out of 2017, 2018, where it seemed like all of these nebulous ICO concepts and startups that were going to create a new decentralized internet were emerging, but actually didn't really deliver much. And so the money narrative, I think, at that time seemed strongest and firmest. And that's why I think we saw DeFi sort of arise out of that. And I was a proponent of that. I mean, if someone asked me in 2018, 2019, what is Web3? I'd be like, I don't really know what you mean by Web3 because it hasn't been developed. I like the ideas of self-sovereignty. And obviously, I think there's potential in disrupting some, but people were talking about, like, yeah, let's create a decentralized social media platform on the 15 transactions per second Ethereum instance. And it's just like, no, that's not going to happen right now. That's not going to happen first. Right. So all of this to say, Chris has a very Web3-centric lens, but that lens on the world and how it's going to impact both tech, music industries, gaming industries, all sorts of consumer product industries, all of these different industries has received a massive amount of validation over the past 12 months ago, and even since we last spoke, which is really cool. And we bring all of that into the conversation today.
At the tail end of the bear market, there was definitely that difference between, like, there's DeFi and then there's Web3, and these things are not the same. And I think the way that Chris frames what Web3 is really, I think, vindicates some of the early ideas of what DeFi was. DeFi is really about lowering the costs of performing financial transactions with other people. But Chris would say this is creating a platform, a network with a lower take rate. And so he's really just talking about the extrapolation from Web 1 to Web 2 to Web 3 as who is providing the services and who gets to capture the wealth. And Chris's version of Web 3 is much more in line with Web 1 in that individuals and communities crop up, make value and share value amongst themselves. And then also the difference now is that these Web3 platforms can also provide services towards the rest of the whole entire world without having a central operator take what Chris says is upwards of larger than 50% of the value that's created. Instead, we have something like 0 to 10% of the value that's created is collected by these Web3 protocols.
So guys, we go through that. We go through the five mental models. It's just a toy. Web3, tokens are the new websites. Your take rate is my opportunity. Networks become economies. And then we conclude with what A16Z is doing in the space, a look at regulatory. And then Chris gives us some fantastic parting wisdom. So make sure you stay tuned to the end. Supercycle, does he believe in that? Or maybe something a little bit different, maybe a riff on that. And of course, if you are a premium subscriber, make sure you tune into the debrief that David and I will do with our thoughts and reflections on this episode. We record those after the episode for all of our Bankless premium subscribers available on the premium feed. So without further ado, we want to thank the sponsors that made this episode possible.
Bankless is proud to be supported by Uniswap. Uniswap is a new paradigm in asset exchange infrastructure. Instead of a cumbersome order book system where trades are matched with other humans, Uniswap is an autonomous piece of software on Ethereum, which is what Ryan and I call a money robot. No human counterparties or centralized intermediaries, just autonomous code on Ethereum. Input the token you want to sell and receive the token you want to buy. Something brand new in the Uniswap ecosystem is the Uniswap Grants program is now accepting applications for grants. We have been saying this for a while and we'll say it again. DAOs have money and they are in need of labor. If you think that you have something to contribute to the Uniswap DAO, apply for a grant to Uniswap. Just look at the size of the Uniswap treasury. It's almost $3 billion. This mountain of capital is looking for labor. Do you have something of value to contribute to the Uniswap DAO? No matter how big or small your idea is, you can apply for a Uni grant at unigrants.org and help steer Uniswap in the direction that you think it should go. That's exactly what we did to get Uniswap to be a sponsor for Bankless, and you can do the same for your project. Thank you, Uniswap, for sponsoring Bankless. The era of proof of stake is upon us. Proof-of-stake systems like Ethereum, Terra, and Solana allow the industry to move away from the hot, loud, and wasteful proof-of-work systems and return back to a cottage industry of individual stakers and individual validators. And that is what we need to make this industry stay decentralized. Individuals must play their part in crypto network validation. And that is what Lido is here to do. Lido makes staking accessible to everyone at the click of a button. By delegating your stake to Lido's network of nodes, you can access the yield offered by proof-of-stake systems and claim your share of the network transaction rewards. Do you have 32 ETH and want to stake it to Ethereum, but running a node sounds intimidating? Or maybe you have less than 32 ETH and you need to pool your ETH with others so you can access staking yields. Lido offers a solution for both. Simply go to Lido.fi, choose which assets you want to stake, and deposit them to the Lido validating network. Lido is working to make sure proof of stake stays as decentralized as possible, and is committed to decentralizing its own validating network to eventually become a completely permissionless protocol. So if you want to stake your ETH, Terra, or Sol and get liquidity on your stake, go to Lido.fi to get started.
Bankless Nation, we are super excited to introduce you to our next guest. He needs no introduction. He's been on Bankless before. This is Chris Dixon. He's a partner at A16Z, where he leads crypto investing. Last time we spoke to Chris was January 2021, if I'm recalling correctly. So that's like roughly 10 years ago, I think, in crypto times. How are you doing, Chris? It's great to have you back on Bankless.
I'm great. I'm great. Thanks for having me. It's good to see you guys.
Ryan, yeah, it's been a while, but you haven't aged a day, even though it's been like a very long time in crypto years. I hope you're...
What's that meme? It's like the Interstellar meme where it's like, you know, it's 4 hours down here. Yeah,
right. He's on the gravity planet.
20 years up there.
Yeah, fantastic movie, by the way. All right, so guy, just for...
Was it that recent? I actually thought it was... Wasn't it DeFi Summer? Like, I thought it was over a year ago. Anyways, maybe not.
It was DeFi Summer. Yeah.
It was at the end of DeFi Summer.
It was before NFT mania. Let's see if we're doing charting this encrypted. Just after DeFi Summer, things were in kind of a lull before ETH went on a tear. Yeah, Bitcoin had just done okay. NFTs were barely a thing. There was no such thing as crypto gaming. Let's see what else happened. Right. I mean, so many other things too.
It's been such an eventful year.
All right. Well, let's talk about this because actually for the listeners, we wanted to start this episode maybe a little bit differently than our others. We wanted to make this kind of a canonical Bankless episode.
Sure.
I mean, we're going to discuss A16Z and what you're doing in crypto, because we can't not. You guys just raised a casual, you know, $2.2 billion, I think, back in June. Yep. So we're definitely going to discuss that. It's probably going to be near the end. But really, where we wanted to turn your brain at first is, for the listener, Chris is not only a brilliant investor, he's a master of mental models. David and I love mental models on Bankless. We think these are like shortcuts for understanding how to approach this space. It's a way to connect the dots. It's the fastest way possible to connect the dots. And like, for those of you who aren't familiar with mental models, first of all, I bet you are familiar with mental models because you use them all the time in your day-to-day life. But it's just a framework that you can carry with you to help explain something, help explain how the world works. And in crypto, we think this is the fastest way to get you from like zero to 60 on a subject, because it's like compressed information, okay? This is like a ZK roll-up for your mind. So we love mental models, and we're actually going to spend the first part of this going through a number of mental models that Chris has helped develop for this industry to help individuals understand it. David, you look like you want to say something about mental models. I know you love them too.
Yeah, absolutely. Just in time for Thanksgiving and Christmas for you to sharpen your sticks and take them home to your families to explain what the hell this whole crypto thing is.
Yeah, they're going to be asking you at the Thanksgiving get together what's going on in crypto these days. You know that. So we're going to dive into five mental models today. I'm just going to list them off, and then we're going to get Chris's brain on each of them. The first is a mental model that I call "It's just a toy."
Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Why new technologies are dismissed. So we'll touch on that. The second is Web3. How do crypto people have the audacity to call this thing Web3? We just like created a whole new era of the internet. We got to talk about that as a mental model. The third is tokens as the new websites. Interesting. Yeah. The fourth is, this is a Bezos quote, "Your take rate is my opportunity."
Yeah.
What do we mean about that in the context of the transition from Web2 to Web3? The fifth is networks becoming economies. Mm-hmm. That is a paradigm shift. So those are the five models. But before we get into the models, Chris, you're a master of mental models.
Thank you.
Why do you like them so much? What's the value of a mental model?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit sort of like all of what scientists do, for example, or anyone trying to predict the future, right? You need to, the world is so complex, you know, 8 billion people, you know, economics, physics, biology, it's way too complex for anyone to understand. And so what you do, I think, when you try to predict the future, and this would apply if you were a scientist, it applies if you're an investor, it applies if you're an entrepreneur, or anyone who's sort of concerned with, you know, thinking about how do these really complex systems evolve. You need simplifications. You need ways to kind of take very complex things and distill them and find patterns. And so to me, that's what these mental models are. And they come from, you know, as with anyone who works full time, I've been working, you know, in the space for 8 years and basically full time in crypto for 5 years, and my whole career in technology. And this is sort of, you know, these are the models I've developed to help my own thinking and my own investing. And also, you know, I think as part of kind of our philosophy of investing and working with entrepreneurs, we'd like to also share these with the world. And look, it's partly to hopefully it's a resource for people, but I also think, you know, it, in the end, our job is to be the place that entrepreneurs want to go to work with. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs appreciate that if you kind of help them along in their entrepreneurial journey, they think that's valuable. Yeah. So I think it's fundamentally about understanding and predicting the world. And one of the things I find so fascinating about the space that we work in, Web3 crypto, is it's just sort of endlessly interesting. Like, you know, that meme where the guy's lying in bed and he's like, she's like, "What are you thinking about?" I'm thinking, and like, this is the one topic in my life where I have never run out of interesting things to think about. Like, I'm never bored because.
Wait, really? Like, more so than like. I mean, you were here for the early days of the internet too, or like the early days of the internet.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's more
interesting.
Maybe it's because I'm in the middle of it more, but I think that this, you know, because this, like, think about it. You think about, like, for example, like, we have different practice areas in our crypto group, right? And I think, like, at least three different areas. So we have infrastructure, DeFi, and sort of NFTs and gaming, and then maybe a fourth area, sort of emerging areas. And you know, in the infrastructure one, like you get all of computer science in there. It's a fascinating area. My partner Lee kind of leads that effort, but I sort of, you know, moonlight doing that. And it's just endlessly interesting. Like now we're getting deep into kind of ZK stuff and cryptography and, you know, spent years on kind of the various kind of scaling kind of concerns. So that's just endlessly interesting. It's computer science, but you're also reasoning about, you know, what people use these things for. And then you have the whole community aspect, right? Of like, a blockchain is not just a computer. It is a computer in the sense that it runs code and stores information, but it's also a community and a network, right? So you have this human aspect to it. You have economics, you have game theory. I don't think, and then you go to NFTs and you have all of that plus culture, mm-hmm. plus media, plus gaming, right? And then you go to DeFi and you have all of that plus finance and, you know, yield farming and degens and just all this like fascinating kind of cultural stuff. So I just think it like there's like 10, for me at least, I feel like the 10 things I've been interested in my life, like programming, economics, game theory, culture, you know, it all kind of comes together. And this is like the great, big, most fascinating thing ever. Yeah, that's my view. I mean, that's why I'm so fired up about it. I'm sure I expect I'm preaching to the choir here, but I spend a lot of time, you know, I spend most of my time meeting with entrepreneurs and learning from them. And then I spend sort of the rest of my time beyond, I mean, I do have a personal life and everything else, but like, so I don't want to make it sound like I only work, but I do work a lot. But I spend the rest of my time kind of processing all that information and trying to come up with ways to understand it. And I think that's where a lot of these mental models come from.
Chris, how has your relationship with mental models progressed throughout your time unpacking the internet? You are an internet veteran. Yeah. You've kind of seen it blossoming mm-hmm. yeah. from all of its forms. Yeah. How have you used mental models and how have your mental models developed from Web 1 to Web 2? Yeah. And then also, how has Web 3 really changed the game with like needing mental models?
Yeah, a great question. I mean, I think the last time I was really excited about the internet was 2009 to 11, I'd say, which to me was the golden period of mobile. And that was a really exciting time. I think one of the fascinating things about that, there were a bunch of interesting things. It was, it's interesting. First of all, it was really underestimated. It seems like today, you know, the iPhone came out in 2007, the App Store in 2008, and it's very easy to tell a story that it was just sort of, okay, mobile's the thing, and that's it. It wasn't the case. So, like, a very important moment was Facebook's mobile pivot in 2012. So 2012 was really, in my mind, 2012 was the year that the tech world realized that mobile is not the secondary computing platform, it's the primary computing platform. So people knew it was a thing and it was important and it was growing, but the extent to which, specifically touch-based smartphones, like, you know, there were many, many cell phones, but there was a lot of controversy as to whether they were really expensive. Go look at that the infamous Steve Ballmer video about the iPhone and no one's going to buy it. It's so expensive. The idea of people paying $1,000 for a phone just seemed kind of crazy. Of course, what they weren't thinking through was, what they underestimated is, first, it's not a phone. It's a supercomputer, internet connected supercomputer, right? Which is worth $1,000. And secondly, and this is the most important thing with computing, new computing waves is there was this exponential improvement curve that it went on, okay? And it was partly the phone itself. If you take a phone today, an iPhone today, and compare it to an iPhone 2011, it's gotten much, much better, right? Just in terms of the performance and the camera. But what's really gotten better are the applications, right? Now you go on and you have just an endless stream of entertainment. You have the smartest people in the world on Twitter. You have, you know, TikTok dance videos. You have ephemeral messaging. You've got a million games. It's a giant rich ecosystem, right? And so it just got, and those two things, this is one of the things that happens in computing waves. And by the way, I'll get back to crypto. I believe we might be in that golden period now. That's one reason I'm so in blockchain, crypto, Web3. Hmm. In the really good golden period, you get this feedback loop. So you've got the application developers coming in and doing cool new stuff, which in turn drives more users and money into the infrastructure layer, meaning like the phone or the blockchain, and that gets better. And as that gets better, that unlocks. So we're, you know, that unlocks new applications. We're already seeing this, I'm sure. Like, for example, in the L2 world, right? Now that you've got real Ethereum L2s, you're now going to have a new class of applications. Now that you've got other L1s that are built for like gaming use cases, as an example, that's going to unlock a whole other range of kind of games, as an example, or NFT use cases. Anyways, so that, you know, so going back, that was a very exciting time. And what was so fun about it is, you had this new thing in your pocket, is this GPS connected smartphone with a camera. What are you going to do with it? Right. That's the creative thing. So, you know, Travis says, hey, I think that the cool thing to do would be to build a worldwide network of, you know, Uber network and ride sharing, and you can click a button and this thing magically shows up, right? Instagram says, you know, I think that now this is going to change. There were photo sharing sites before, but they were like these snapfish, like get your family photos printed kind of thing. This is going to change kind of the way that people consume, create and consume photography, media, video, and so forth, right? So new, this very creative period of people thinking of new use cases. And the early web had this kind of thing too. The internet, I think, has kind of had four important distinct phases. There was web one, where, you know, this sort of this explosion of stuff in the 90s. And the key feature there, it was governed by open protocols, which meant that because Sergey and Larry and other entrepreneur, you know, all the kind of main, you know, Pierre Omidyar, eBay, Google, Amazon, because they were open protocols, they knew they could build internet services that they would truly own and control, that no one could kind of rug pull them the way that you get rug pulled on a platform on the iPhone or on Facebook or something. But that first wave, those applications were what I call skeuomorphic. They took kind of things that were from the offline world, like magazines, and put them on the internet. And then, so a lot of the websites were just kind of one way. You were just reading stuff. And then there was this next period in the 2000s where a new wave of entrepreneurs came along and they said, wait a second, no, these are computers. And you can read and write and put code and do all sorts of other things. And that's when you had first this kind of early phase where you probably never heard of them, but like things like Flickr and Delicious and 6degrees, early social networking. And there was kind of people, you know, they were kind of they were building kind of the early primitives and the early ideas. And then you had Mark Zuckerberg and Ev Williams and Jack Dorsey and other people take those and package them up really beautifully. And boom, that was Web 2. And then Web 2 got accelerated by mobile, which was sort of another layer of interesting stuff that happened on top. And then I think we had a period of just kind of incumbent domination between 2012 and 20 or something, you know, where Apple and Google, et cetera, these companies get bigger and bigger. And the internet is now at a precarious point where it could turn into kind of TV, where you have like four channels, like CBS and NBC, like TV in the 70s or something. I think we'd all agree would be
God,
a bad.
I hope not.
That's what the great cause that we're all fighting for here is to keep the internet open and interesting and not like that, right? But then you had this, as you both well know, you had this kind of counter trend that began to develop, obviously originally with Satoshi, and then I think very importantly with Vitalik and Ethereum, and then I think that's led to really kind of a explosion and these feedback loops that I've described before, an explosion of innovation. And now I think, you know, I think we could be in that moment, that golden period moment. I remember very much in mobile, like I was there and we knew mobile was a big deal, but it's very hard to know when you're in a process, is it linear or exponential? Because you're sitting on one point and you don't really know how fast it's going.
Have there been some things, Chris, where like you thought they were exponential and they turned out to be linear?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, look, I started a machine learning company in 2008, and I was clearly too early on that. It was called Hunch. It was acquired by eBay in 2011. If you'd asked me, and I, you know, in 2008, I said, this is going to be the thing. It's going to change the world. AI is finally at a point where it's really going to happen. AI had like a 50-year period of kind of false starts, you know, going back to Alan Turing, who predicted that, I forget exactly, but someone would pass a Turing test, would be able to simulate, act like a human. I think he said within 30 years or something, way overly optimistic. The field was seen as kind of a disappointment. And I believed that people were underestimating. And so I created this company and we had this recommendation technology AI stuff. And I think I was right. I just unfortunately was too early. And, you know, that's, as they say in venture, too early is the same as being wrong. So I guess I was wrong. But I think that, look, there's certainly technology kind of trends that people get excited about that don't fully pan out. A lot of times, though, I think it's too early. I think VR is a good example where I think, you know, we invested, I led our investment in Oculus in 2013, and I thought it was 3 years away. I think it's actually right around the corner right now. I think it's about to really kind of get really big, and it's finally there, and people are underestimating it, but it took longer. So usually at least my mistake, like before I went and started a crypto fund, I did a kind of full personal audit of all of the things I've believed and whether I've been right or wrong to really kind of see how highly convicted I am. And I came to the conclusion that along the thread of software and computer science, which is what I've always been interested in, like internet and software, pretty much everything that a lot of smart people got excited about has happened. It's only been a question of time. I have this blog post, what the smartest people do on the weekend, everyone else will do in 10 years. And I think that's been universally true for the last 50 years in software, that the things that, you know, the Steve Jobs and the Wozniak going to the homebrew computer club and like all the smartest computer science nerds in California in the 1970s were right. And the people at the big companies who bet against PCs were wrong. That's happened over and over. Mm-hmm. It happened with the internet. It happened with open source software. And I think it's going to happen here as well.
And Chris, I think that's one of the big mental models that you've communicated is this whole Web 1, Web 2, Web 3, and all these denominations of the web are just mental models, mm-hmm. right? Each one is its own mental model. And you talked about like, well, wouldn't that just be terrible if the internet just collapsed onto like four channels, the YouTube channel, the Facebook channel, the Instagram channel, and the Twitter channel.
Which is kind of where we're getting close to.
Right. And so as a veteran of the Web 1 era, mm-hmm. how do you see Web 3 reinstantiating some of the cool things and that we liked about Web 1?
Yeah. Well, I think a big part is having credibly neutral platforms upon which to build, right? So if you build an application on top of Ethereum, and whether it be a game or something, an NFT experience or a DeFi protocol, you do not have to worry about the protocol deciding to kick you off later or charge you 30% of your take rate or whatever, you know, happens on these other kinds of platforms. And so you know that you can invest and spend your life as an entrepreneur betting on that platform and building around it. In the same way in the Web 1, you knew that you could do that around HTTP and SMTP. It's very, very different to, I think a very formative moment in my experience, I don't know if you were both in tech then, was the Facebook, Twitter API massacre, essentially, which is there were all of these, there was a huge wave of people that built startups on Facebook and Twitter, and they were all just summarily kind of shut off. I had a lot of friends who had startups that were built on the Twitter API. It was a developer platform for many years. Mm-hmm. Yes, it had users using it directly, but it actually didn't even have an app for a long time. It was all third-party apps. And those were all companies. And those were people who'd spent their lives on it. And Twitter did, by the way, I'm friends with a lot of these people at these Web 2 companies. I don't think they have any ill intent. I think the problem is the model. The model is...
Importantly, to put these into crypto terms, the lack of immutability of the Web 2 model.
And the lack of immutability, meaning they can change the... Like I like to say in Web 3, it's can't be evil. In Web 2, it's don't be evil. So Web 2, you're depending on the kind of the good intentions of the founders. Part of it's architectural, right? You don't have a blockchain. You don't have like a code that is locks them into it. And if you build something on Ethereum, the code is locking you into certain commitments. If you build a smart contract, it's there, it's immutable, everything else. But it's also just the model of, look, maybe if you're an ultra founder, Jack Dorsey or something, you can resist this. But for almost everybody else, you ultimately report to shareholders. And those shareholders want you to maximize profits. And that, I believe, is fundamentally inconsistent with maximizing the health of the networks built on top. I think that corporations and networks are fundamentally misaligned. The corporation is going to want to grab more and more of the money and close off the network. When the network, what the network wants, what the people on the network want, is they want openness and low take rates and open permissionless access. Okay. And those two things are fundamentally misaligned. In the last 10 years, we've seen how that misalignment plays out. And I think a lot of the reason people are unhappy on these networks is they feel this viscerally. A lot of these creators who were early to build YouTube up are now, you know, at the whims of the algorithm, at the whims of the company. They get demonetized, they get the take rates changed, and they feel viscerally they were part of this network creation. And they should have been part of the governance and economics of the network, but they aren't. And as you know, Web3, using tokens and all of these other kinds of new primitives that we have with Web3, we can now fix that. And we can build networks where there isn't a corporation that needs to increase the take rate and shut down access, where the network can flourish, where the users and on the network and the developers on the network can participate in the value creation and the governance of those networks. My friend Brad Burnham, he's a co-founder of Union Square Ventures, has a phrase that he finally discovered the native asset class of information networks, tokens.
Wow.
We were mismatching this other asset class, the Delaware C Corp, with networks. And that created all this endless strife. And we now have a way to fix that.
This is super cool. And I think this is basically what we've been getting into, if listeners aren't aware, is your first mental model, which is the mental model of Web3. And like the question of, how do these crypto people have the audacity to like label this new crypto thing that they're working on an entirely new era of the internet, right? Like some people don't understand that because it's so early in the journey, right? So, but you're saying Web3 is basically, it's this internet that's owned by the builder and users, and it's orchestrated with tokens, and it's a less predatory relationship between the platform and users, right? Because, you know, in the Web2 model, the platform, the users, with growth comes this extraction from the users of an individual platform or a network. Yeah. In Web3, I guess it's more of a symbiotic type relationship.
Yeah.
Do you think it's still audacious to call this thing Web3, or do you feel this is right on still?
Yeah. I think it's right on. I think in terms of the audacity of it, you know, time will tell. I very publicly have put these out there, and we put a lot of money on the line. And if we're wrong, we'll lose a lot of money, and we'll look silly. And so, we definitely have skin in the game, and I definitely believe this. I'm 100% sure we won't be wrong. This is definitely right. And look, there's a descriptive aspect to this. I think there's a real movement going on, but there's also a prescriptive aspect, which is I want to put up the bat signal. I want to put up the bat signal and say, if you're at Google or at Amazon and you believe the internet can be a better place than it is today, and you don't want to spend your life, on ad targeting, there's an alternative, and you can come start a company. We're always wanting to meet entrepreneurs and potentially fund them, or you can come join a company. We have hundreds, probably thousands of openings in our portfolio. And so, these things, I remember the Web2 thing, it's not just, it's a participatory process. And the key thing now, I believe, is getting more talented people into the space. Most of the discussions I do, why I'm, sort of the audience I'm imagining today when I'm speaking to you, are people who are curious about the space, could contribute something, whether it be design, engineering, some other, business operations function, whatever it might be. I want them to hear this and know that we want you to come join us. We're welcoming and we need you. This is not going to happen with, my blog posts, right? And it's going to happen because thousands of entrepreneurs and tens of thousands of people working with them build great products that billions of people want to use.
Would you go so far, Chris, as to say Web2 has peaked? I mean, like it's kind of done, now it's on the decline, and now this is all about Web3?
That's a great question. Look, I think it's nuanced. So Web2, defined as the big companies, their market caps are high, they're doing very well economically. I don't know anyone who works. I do know people who work at these companies. None of them seem very inspired. They all seem, they've gotten very corporate. Only one of the big companies is led by a founder anymore. I have trouble thinking of, I guess I would ask you, is there a product that, let's say, Google has launched in the last 10 years that you find exciting?
No, I use many of their products, right? But there's nothing new.
I bet they're all from the 2000s.
Like
Maps, search,
and they're not exciting.
What in the last decade? I mean, Apple, I would say, I get AirPods. I like AirPods.
AirPods are great.
But I mean, this is a company that had a run of literally in its 8-year period, the iPod, the iPhone, the iPad. That was whatever 2000. I don't know, 1 to 9. And since then, it's been the AirPods. They have $2 trillion. Like, what's going on? Bell Labs, when they had a monopoly, like they created the transistor, Unix, the C programming language. Probably a whole long list of things I don't remember. So are they doing? I know Zuckerberg is controversial. That thing yesterday, they're spending $10 billion on VR.
It's something new, at least.
He's doing, in my mind, like, I know he's controversial and everything else. Yeah, it's this. What else would you do if you're like a billionaire tech founder? Like, you should be making big bold bets, right? So I don't know how much innovation. I don't feel like they're doing much innovation. I, I mean, just literally count up the products. Like,
So, Chris, let's assume that's true. Like, so let's assume there's no innovation. Let's assume Web 2 has peaked for a minute.
I mean, it's not no innovation, but it's top of the S curve. It's incremental. It's incremental. Like, the phones do get a little bit better. I just got the new iPhone. Like, I use these products. I think they make very good hardware.
New camera, better.
But it feels very incremental. Like, I used to watch every Apple keynote. Like, it was like the Super Bowl. Same. Right now. Like, I haven't watched one in 7 years. It's okay. They have another fourth camera or whatever.
Better camera, better battery, faster chip. That's about it.
Well, so I'm curious about this.
Where are the bold bets? Like, where are the bold bets with all that money and all those resources?
If, let's say for a minute, that many Web 2 companies become sort of maybe incumbents, or they sort of miss this Web 3 phase, do you think it's likely that they'll miss this Web 3 things?
Yes, I do.
What I'm actually wondering is, do you think that Web 2 will see Web 3 as competitors? Do you think they'll be completely asleep at the wheel and miss it? Or do you think they'll start to collaborate? What's been interesting since last time we spoke is, like, even like little glimpses, you know, Twitter talking about adding NFT features. It's really cool. It's what we want. I want a verified blue check mark for my NFT Twitter. Thank you very much. It sounds like that's what they're building. TikTok doing some things in the NFT minting space. So, like, they're, but do you think that's going to that trend's going to continue? The Web 2 starts to work with Web 3, or do you think they're just going to get their lunch eaten?
I hope so. I hope so. I think my guess is it'll be different with founder-led companies. That the founder-led companies, they've seen this pattern before. They've seen these things people have dismissed as a toy that come from below, that seem silly, that get called a scam, and they realize it's not. And so it doesn't surprise me that Twitter and Square and Facebook and, you know, Instagram, which of course is owned by Facebook, are on the leading edge of this. I think we'll see a lot of those folks add things like those NFT features. I think it'll get really interesting. So the soft underbelly of Web 2 is not, I think the adoption pattern, like, it, for Web 2, the adoption pattern was get a whole bunch of users. This is sort of Ben Thompson's kind of theory, aggregation theory, get 100 million users and then layer on monetization. I think Web 3 is going to be the opposite, which is the way that it's going to start with the creators. And the soft underbelly of Web 2 is that the take rates are anywhere from 0 to, you know, like 50%. So if you are and by the way, this, forget about putting crypto aside for a second. Are you familiar with Substack? So Substack, right? It's a newsletter platform that it's very interesting because you have these writers. So all the writers have been told for 20 years, the internet is bad for you. The internet destroys your business. You can't make money as a writer online. You have to go do all this other stuff, and maybe you'll scrape by. Maybe if you're really lucky, you get to work at, you know, the New York Times or something. But in general, it's not a real career, and you have to do something else. And these writers go on Substack, and there's a whole bunch of writers making $1 million a year. And this is like, whoa, narrative violation. We were told you can't do that, right? It's not, the problem is not the internet. The problem is Web 2. The problem is we put in between the writers and their audience algorithmic feeds and ads. And that was not a good, and companies that decided to take almost all the money, right? So Spotify, the statistic I like is that it's on their website. They have 8 million artists, and of that, only 14,000 make $50,000 a year or more. So make sort of the average American living. So 14,000 out of 8 million. They put that on their website. They think it's a good thing. Like, think about how engaged people are with music, how much they love music, right? A lot of what's going on with NFTs, it's the Substack effect. It's now I can finally, you know, Blau does an NFT drop and makes $11 million. It's because now as a music fan, I'm sure music people are incredibly passionate about music. I would guess that you each have musicians that you love and you'd love to patronize and you'd love to support and you'd love to join their community, or maybe you are in their community, but you'd love to do, you know, you would add into your participation various monetary things. We see this effect offline, by the way. Musicians make a lot of money on offline merchandise. This is just sort of, you know, this is just a way to sell direct NFTs in many ways. You can see it's just digital merchandise, right? At least for musicians, it's one way to look at it. It's finally they have something to sell on the internet that doesn't require going through an intermediary and having banner ads and all sorts of other things.
I mean, this could be like the native tokens. You said it's sort of the native asset of networks. This could be the native asset of, you know, tokens could be the native asset for creators too, and for communities and for fans.
Well, that's what I think there will be. I think they will be. And I think what we'll start to see is more and more creators realize this and realize they can opt out of the Web 2 monetization. They may still use Web 2 as a way to kind of aggregate fans, but as they start to opt out and they say, hey, you know what? I don't need YouTube's, you know, advertising banner ads. I can just use YouTube as a way to kind of get a bunch of, this is what happens with Substack. You know, these authors, they get their audience on Twitter, and then they put a link that says, you know, if you want to support me, go to Substack. And what that in ad-based models, that never worked because you needed to get like the entire audience to move over. In these kind of cream-skimming models, which is NFTs and Substack, where you just try to get sort of the biggest fans, the 1,000 truest fans to pay you money. In the cream skimming model, you can use Twitter to aggregate 1 million people. And if 1,000 come over and sign up for your Substack and pay you whatever, $10 a month, you've got a living, right? And that's going to happen more and more with NFTs.
Sorry. Meanwhile, if Bankless listeners can go over to our Substack and sign up for Bankless, we would greatly appreciate it.
Yeah. Chris, you'll love this, actually. So I think Substack is a perfect example because it's one of these bridge companies. Mm-hmm. It's a bridge in the creator economy between like Web 2 and Web 3, right? But it's like not fully tokenized. But like Bankless got its start on Substack in 2020. Yes. We started with just like, 2019, yeah. 2 years ago. And we started with like just a handful on Twitter, as you said, right? We just hit 100,000 subscribers.
That's awesome.
Just like in the past week. And what's interesting, we love Substack because it's a direct relationship with our community. And it also strikes me that, you know, the Substack model is not kind of it's like the bridge company. It's still in the old world.
Yeah.
Imagine if you could like supercharge a Substack. What does a Substack look like that's a bit more decentralized and a bit more tokenized, you know? Like something like a Mirror is interesting in doing things like this. It's like, these bridge companies are going to be very important as well. And
no, I think that's right. Yeah, I think that's ahead. Right. I think Substack, Patreon, Kickstarter back in the day are all kind of early precursors. But the strong form, as you say, would be to have the subscription. Maybe it was an NFT or some other kind of thing. And you give governance rights and economic rights and a whole bunch of other kind of things. But I think, I think they're right. I think these bridging companies are very important culturally because they kind of provide a easier on-ramp for understanding the effects here. You were asking, just to answer your question from before, will Web 2 respond to Web 3? I think when they start to see the creators taper off and opt out of some of their programs, because that's their soft underbelly. They're very strong on the network effects on the user side, right? Like I talk about Web 3 all the time. It would be hard for me to leave Twitter because I have a lot of followers there. I spent a lot of years doing it. Right. It's hard. And they don't let you leave. Substack, by the way, very importantly, lets you leave. You can export. First thing I check when I sign up for Substack, can I export my email list? Right. You can take your network with you. Right. And that's a very important thing. I wouldn't use any trust starting a new site unless you can take your network with you. But anyway, so I think that'll be interesting if that starts to happen and you start to see because the Web 2 models are all built around this kind of everyone's locked in and we have these permanent network effects. And so if you start to see any chips of that armor, that's going to be alarming to them and how they respond. You know, the right way to respond, hopefully, is embrace the future. It's, you know, the way that Bill Gates finally did five alarm fire and built Internet Explorer, right? When the internet was coming along, he missed it at first, but he, to his credit, recovered very quickly. And so I think that's the right way to do it, but we'll see. I think you'll see a big difference with the founder-led companies is my guess. Because the ones that aren't founder-led, it's very hard. They form a committee, they study the issue. You know, they have to go kind of get consensus. Mm-hmm. It's very hard for a non-founder-led company to do non-consensus big bets.
Chris, in your article, you talk about the role of tokens when it comes to these Web3 networks. And you say this line, tokens push ownership and control to the margins, which should come with a lot of contrast to these Web2 worlds where it's very, very top-down updates to the way that these platform works. And then we've also seen this like revolution in airdrops and also earning by using as an instrument, a tool. How do these tokens actually allow us to build this Web3 world?
Yeah, I think tokens. So the way I define Web3 is an internet owned by users and builders, orchestrated by tokens. So tokens to me are the kind of the key new concept, the new primitive, as we say. There's two basic types of tokens. There's fungible and non-fungible NFTs. So when I say token, it could be one or the other. Tokens are besides domain names, which is sort of the one thing you could own in Web1. They're the first thing on the internet where a user can actually own something and like truly own it in the sense that no one can take it away, right? If you, the key idea with a token, it's in your wallet and your wallet is a private key and a public key. By the way, by this definition, Bitcoin is a token, of course, as well. And of course, it was the pioneer of this model. And those tokens are, it's a very general concept. This is one of the mental models you mentioned, the tweets storms I'd
written. We're on to mental model number two for the listeners, by the way.
So tokens are like web pages in the sense that they're very, very general, general primitive. So when the first websites came along, they you know, they had certain personality. They had pictures on them. They had text, and people said, oh, I see. It's like a magazine, right? But then over time, and the other thing, by the way, that web page can have is it can have pictures and text and it can have code, right? And over time, developers iterated and built more and more new ideas and new kind of types of things, types of websites. And so today you have, you know, social networking, you have very elaborate SaaS software, you have spreadsheets, Google Docs. And today we can see, we can appreciate kind of when we use the web, how the general concept of website is. So when we talk about tokens, when they start off, for example, with NFTs, people see Bored Apes and CryptoPunks and they say, oh, it's sort of like art or something, or it's sort of like, right click and save JPEG. I believe instead it's a much more general concept, and we're going to see people iterate on it. And so, for example, in gaming, we're seeing a lot of crypto Web3 gaming now. You're going to see tokens represent game objects, as an example, which have real utility. And so maybe it's a magical sword, but it has certain properties. And the user can take that sword and take it out of the game into another game. And I think over time, gamers are going to expect that they have their kind of permanent inventory. Right? Today, you go and you play a game. I play Clash Royale a lot, if you play games, and I've spent probably too much money on that game. And then when I stop playing it, it's all gone, right? And we just sort of get used to this idea that you're basically going in and renting the goods and then giving them up. People will, I think, over time say, why is that? Like, in the real world, that's not how it works. Like, you don't go to when I go to a restaurant, I don't have to put on a new set of clothing and then give it back at the end or something, right? Like, you have your permanent stuff in the real world. People, that's a very popular concept in the real world, to own stuff. We just never had it until tokens on the internet. Mm-hmm. Now we have a notion of owning stuff. That's what tokens are. And so they can be fungible, tend to be corner money-like things like Ether or Bitcoin or something, and non-fungible are sort of everything else. And as a friend, Roham, our friend at Dapper Labs, likes to say, most of the world is non-fungible. So he you can debate this, but he believes sort of non-fungible will be, in the end, be sort of 95% of the tokens in the world, just simply because it'll look like the real world where you have, I'm sitting here, I have a computer, that's an object. I have a Pepsi, that's an object. And we have money too. I have fungible stuff too, but it's not the kind of majority of the world. So what tokens allow is, it's just this concept of digital ownership. And it can be a thing, it can be a piece of media, it can be a game utility, it can be something fashionable, it can be an avatar, it can be code. I think we're about to see a whole bunch of new iteration on the idea of like having programmable NFTs, as an example. It could be a ticket, it could be access to something in the real world, it could be a behind the scenes, pass for a Discord, it can be anything. Mm-hmm. The key thing is you can now own it. It's not, it flips the model where the user has the object and the application or website is asked to interact with that object, as opposed to the application or website creating the whole world and expecting the user to adapt to it. It's a user-centric new way to think about the internet.
I want to double click on that right there. So I have Trustless Date as my Twitter handle, but I don't own that. Jack Dorsey just lets me borrow that, and he can like pull it back for me whenever I want.
And by the way, he may. I think at some point, I would not be surprised to see Web 2 start deplatforming Web 3.
By the way, Jack Dorsey, please don't deplatform me from Twitter.
One day it'll just disappear. It'll just be gone.
Okay. So, but that I want to unpack about how this actually changes the relationship between a user and a website. Mm-hmm. When I go to Twitter, I'm not bringing along my personal belongings. I don't even own my own Twitter account. Twitter just lets me borrow this Trustless Date Twitter account from them. Meanwhile, in Web3, I have a bunch of these objects in my inventory and I go to these websites and I bring along my objects and say, hey, website, look at these objects that I have. How does this change the relationship between website and user?
It significantly, it shifts power towards the user, right? So if I go, and you know this as an active user. So I'm sure you have yours, ETH name. I have cdixon.eth and I have an avatar associated with it. Mm-hmm. And when I go, first of all, the login experience, the login experience is magical. I think you need to really try it to see it. But I go to OpenSea and then I go to Rainbow and I see my name and my ETH handle and all my other inventory. And they're just providing kind of a view for it, like a way to view it, but they don't own the actual data. Right. And what that means is they have to play much more nicely because they don't have that much. Twitter doesn't care. They can do whatever they want.
They don't have that much control.
No, they don't. It just weakens it. It weakens the, so you will have centralized services in the mix. And like, it'll be reflected in the take rates. Like OpenSea, like we're big investors in OpenSea, full disclosure. And I know there's some controversy in the decentralized world, but look, it's it, I do think there's a role for centralized services, and they charge 2.5%, right? Which is in stark, I mean, the lowest Web2 take rate is Apple at 30%. YouTube is 50%, and Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook give zero, i.e. they charge 100%, right? So I,
Chris, can you just define take rates really quick?
Sure, take rate. In any kind of marketplace, there's just what does the house take? What percentage does the service provider, the intermediary, what percentage do they take? And like I believe that, like I'm a capitalist, I think there's a role for marketplaces in the world, and marketplaces should get paid. I think a healthy take rate is something like 2.5%, right? I think an unhealthy take rate is, you know, when you have 100%, which is Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and 50% YouTube and 30% Apple for doing very little in the case of Apple, like that to me is a sign of a basically a monopoly. Like it's not, that's not a healthy take rate.
What's super interesting about OpenSea is like a very low take rate. Yeah, at the same time, it's like, you know, you're a capitalist, you're investing, obviously, with the expectation of future returns. It's like OpenSea's got to be one of the fastest growing companies in existence, and certainly it's been the breakout of the year, right? So that take rate has not impacted their ability to grow. There just seems to be something about this Web3 world where you get such like accelerated growth that I don't know that I've ever seen. Maybe this happened in the mobile world in that era, and maybe it happened in early days Facebook, but like we haven't seen it since those two previous eras of the internet.
I completely agree. And look, go. I don't know if you ever read S-1s. So when a company files to go public, there's the S-1, which is the financial statement. Go look at the last 2 years of tech S-1s and look at the budget for sales and marketing. It is in most cases the by far the biggest expense. We basically all of the entire tech world today spends the majority of their money on sales and marketing. And that could be everything from if you're a consumer company, you're buying Facebook ads. If you're an enterprise company, you're buying, you know, you have a big expensive sales force. To my knowledge, like almost no crypto company has ever spent money on marketing. Actually, the Web2 platforms banned all crypto ads, which is probably actually a favor, but so they wouldn't get on the sugar high. But to my knowledge, like, think about Bitcoin. This is Bitcoin's a canonical example, right? Bitcoin, of course, doesn't spend any, there is no Bitcoin company. They don't spend money on marketing, but they've got an army of how many 100 million people who write millions of, you know, Medium posts and tweets and, you know, all of these evangelists. It's a religion. Okay. And so I think why has crypto grown so quickly without any marketing? Because people feel skin in the game. They feel ownership, and that causes them to go evangelize. And it's a very, very powerful force. And so I think the trade as an investor, yes, we will get lower take rates, but we will have much bigger markets. And that will, I think those two will balance out, and it's a perfectly, you know, it's a perfectly good place to invest in, but we can do it in a way that is a much, much broader, bigger market and have platforms that have far smaller take rates. It's sort of what happened with, you know, Craigslist is a good example, I think, which is just a giant market, you know, huge amount of volume goes through there. They take very little. I think they only charge in certain categories and relatively low percentage. And they made that calculation. They said, you know what, let's just make it so popular and so good, and it'll grow so fast. Mm-hmm. And they spend no money on marketing, and it's just all profit because that's it. Just like it's that website. Like, that's nothing else left to do. Like they literally, I don't think they have any staff hardly outside the website. So it's just a different way to run one of these things, right? Whereas Google, I think, is up to 120,000 people. It's just a different way to think about the world, right? So I think in this world, you have two kind of things. You have the protocols or the NFTs, and then you'll have things like, I believe there is a role for Coinbase's and OpenSea's, kind of a layer of some centralized services with low take rates that provide kind of an on-ramp. Because you do need these sort of on-ramp experiences, right? It's very hard if you don't have some kind of website and things for new people to come on and you know, kind of join.
Chris, you've already unpacked this a little bit, but I want to approach this subject a little bit more directly. Mm-hmm. In this mental model, you talked about how some of the early websites were just like digital internet versions of a magazine or a newspaper. So you could read the newspaper, or you could go onto the website and read the same newspaper there before they really learned to be a little bit more interactive and engaging and actually have like an actual, like what we know as a website today. And today in the world of NFTs, we have like comically known as JPEG NFTs.
Yeah.
Do you kind of think that's following the same pattern as like this whole JPEG NFT phenomenon is the internet trying to just replicate a magazine on a website?
I think it's probably, I mean, I'm a fan of, you know, of a lot of these NFTs and the CryptoPunks and Bored Apes and things like that. So I'm a fan of them. I do think we're probably very early in the evolution, right? Most of the stuff now is either kind of one of one crypto art. So for examples in Investors in Foundation, which does that, Super Rare does that. Or it's the PFP, the avatar kind of stuff. But we're seeing some really interesting new things. I'm sure you followed the loot stuff that Dom Hoffman did. I think it's fascinating. And that, you know, a couple of interesting things he does. You know, one is the, you know, it's the composability. It's the first loot drop is just the inventories of these imagined characters. And my analogy I use is if, you know, Ernest Hemingway just released the first page of his book and then had the audience write the rest or something, right? It's very provocative. Yes. to like leave the rest undone. And it really emphasizes.
Yeah. Have you guys ever read that book, Stone Soup?
Oh, yeah. It's where he keeps putting stuff in the soup and yeah.
Yeah, basically, he gets this entire town. So he starts with a stone, and everyone contributes like carrots and vegetables. And pretty soon, like he created soup out of a stone, but he only brought the stone.
That's a good analogy. You know, my partner Eddie Lazarin, he's got this great framework where he says that when you make something into an NFT, you do two things: you financialize it, can now be traded, but you also make it composable. And the financialization has gotten all the attention, but I think one of the cool things about loot is it's trying to emphasize this other aspect of it, which is the composability. And if you follow the synthetic loot and more loot, which are both attempts. So synthetic loot is another version of loot where every single public key wallet gets a synthetic loot. And then more loot is one where the supply is by design huge. And the idea with those two is to kind of tier it. So loot is rare. Looks rare, is, you know, and the price goes up, but then it makes it less accessible. And so then synthetic loot and more loot are meant to be for new people to come in and be able to play the game, right? So Dom's doing part of that. Also is a very interesting experiment between kind of the trade-offs of financialization and accessibility. Top Shot has a similar thing where there's these there's rare cards that are sort of meant to be collectibles and hopefully, you know, go up in value, and then there's common cards where, you know, so kids can come on and get a card for $5 and play games and do other things. So I think I'm just giving you an example of like, we're so early in the design space. I think one of the negatives of CryptoPunks is they're so expensive. Like we want, and it's neat and it creates a culture and, you know, I'm a big fan, but we also want to figure out how do we scale this to a billion people and make sure it's accessible and make sure, you know, people are enjoying themselves and feeling skin in the game and ownership. And so I think that, for example, is a very interesting problem that people are working on. One of the things that really gives me a lot of encouragement. So we have I tweeted about this yesterday, but we have a games group at our firm that's not, you know, they're not crypto. They're just sort of traditional games, like, and they invest in really top game developers who come out of places like Riot and Valve and Epic, which are kind of the best game companies, talent companies in the world. And I think it was about 4 months ago, it was after Axie blew up. Just every single meeting they have now involves NFTs. Yeah. In fact, we've funded.
I was going to say, I'm betting they have some crazy
these people are really good designers. I've seen the stuff and it's another level. Like, it's going to be awesome. I think it's kind of like when I was describing the web and web 2 and how it took 10 years for people to really iterate and go beyond the magazine phase. I think it might be happening a lot faster now. And that's one of the indicators, is seeing how talented these people are and how sophisticated. And they, by the way, games people get crypto very quickly. A DAO. Oh, it's a guild, you know, token. They're used to in-game economies. Like they get it instantly. It's not a big learning curve. And so that's very exciting. It's sort of the next, you know, the mind virus has now leapt out of containment into the next place.
Well, I mean, think about this too. It's like, you know, speaking of how fast this could happen, like Web 2 didn't have Web 2 itself.
That's right.
Now crypto has Web 2. Right. So we just propagate on Twitter and Discord and like all of these YouTube, all of these various channels.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. That's why these, by the way, these analogies, these historical analogies are always imperfect because it's just different, right? Mm-hmm. And by the way, a big thing with Web 1 is broadband.
Yeah.
You literally had to have companies like Verizon and Comcast like dig holes and everything else to get to the point where you could have YouTube, right? We don't have that issue now. We have the hardware is all built out, the wireless, you know, phones, and we have Web 2.
Gemini is the world's most trusted cryptocurrency exchange. I've been a customer of Gemini since I first got into crypto in 2017, and it's been my main exchange of choice to make my crypto buys and sells. Gemini is available in all 50 states and in over 50 countries worldwide. And on Gemini, there are markets for over 30 various different crypto assets, including many of the hot DeFi tokens. And it's one of the few exchanges that has liquid DAI markets. Gemini just launched their Earn program, where you can earn up to 7.4% interest on 26 various crypto assets. If you're tired of paying fees in DeFi, or you don't want to worry about DeFi exploits, but you still want to earn interest on your crypto assets, Gemini Earn is the product for you. Another product I'm stoked to get my hands on is the Gemini CryptoBack credit card, which gives you 3% cash back on all of your purchases, but paid to you in your preferred crypto asset. When I get my Gemini credit card, I'm going to make sure that I get my cash back in ETH. So whenever I buy something, I get a little bit of ETH bonus back to me at the same time. You can open up a free account in under 3 minutes at Gemini.com/gobankless. And if you trade more than $100 within the first 30 days after sign up, you'll be gifted a free $15 Bitcoin bonus. Check them out at Gemini.com/gobankless. The Aave protocol is a decentralized liquidity protocol on Ethereum, which allows users to supply and borrow certain crypto assets. Aave version 2 has a ton of cool features that makes using the Aave protocol even more powerful. With Aave, you can leverage the full power of DeFi money Legos, yield, and composability all in one application. On Aave, there are a ton of assets that you can supply to the protocol in order to gain yield, and all of those same assets can also be borrowed from the protocol if you have supplied collateral. Here you can see me borrowing 200 USDC against my portfolio of a number of different DeFi tokens and ETH. I'll choose a variable interest rate because it's a lower rate than the stable interest rate option, but I could choose the stable interest rate option if I wanted to lock in that interest rate in permanently. V2 also features the ability for users to swap collateral without having to withdraw their assets, trade them on Uniswap, and then deposit them back into Aave. With Aave, users can do this in one seamless transaction, saving you time and gas costs. Check out the power of Aave at aave.com. That's AAVE.com.
So we talked about Web3,
yeah.
How crypto has the audacity to call it Web3. We talked about tokens as the new websites. This is the new digital primitive. Mm-hmm. This is like the website of Web3, these things called tokens. Just touch really briefly. I know we touched upon it, but like the idea of your take rate is my opportunity.
Yeah.
Okay. This is a Bezos quote. And he was talking in terms of like, I guess, Web 1, Amazon, how he was going to like beat his e-commerce competitors and the brick and mortars of the world. How does that apply to Web3 versus like Web2?
Yeah.
You wrote a whole thread on that.
Yeah. So Bezos' insight, right, was that he had a different cost structure than his competitors who had physical retail locations and other kinds of things. And he could take that different cost structure and lower his prices and take their market from them. And so his famous quote, your take rate,
your margin, I think he said is
your margin. Yeah. He said your margin. Yeah. So my version of it was your take rate, which is sort of the marketplace version of that. And it's to say, Axie Infinity, we're investors in Axie Infinity. They have this giant economy. I think they're at something on the order of 1.8 million users. And I think, I forgot, I tweeted the other day, I think it was 2 billion, 3 billion in total GMV volume in the last, whatever it's been since launch. But it's very different, right? So when Fortnite makes 3 million, it means people spent 3 million and sent it to Fortnite, sent it to Epic, the company. When Axie does it, they take a tax. I don't know what it is. It's like 3% or something. It's some low take rate.
Maybe 4.7%.
Is that right? Yes, sorry. Yeah. My partner Ariana is on the board. She knows the details. I'm not as close to it. So they take, let's say, 4.7%. But the other 95% goes from one player to another player. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, for the recipient is awesome. And so you have this huge community, I think a lot of it's in the Philippines, that is making a living playing this game. And so the kind of the insight is that the Axie founders had is we can, instead of having the be sort of a command economy where everything is coming to us, we'll make it peer-to-peer. And one set of users can be, can kind of, who have more time than money, can do this kind of work to earn money. And the other set of users who have more money than time can pay for it.
So we actually recently had a conversation with Ariana Simpson from A16Z.
And we
talked about how all gaming platforms, all games ultimately become economies.
Yep.
And it's this, the existence of an economy where so much value can be shared peer to peer generates this flywheel of economic resources that actually a low take rate, if it was 100% of a take rate, you would just kill the economy.
That's right.
If it's a low take rate, you actually encourage the economy to grow.
That's right. And you get these secondary effects, right? Which is, so one of the really fascinating things about Axie is it's not available in any of the app stores because they ban all of the Web3 stuff. And so they have grown to that level that quickly because people, it's what I was talking about before, skin in the game. It's feeling like true owners. It's feeling like they, you know, they can really participate in it. And that, that low, the low take rate is a key part of that, right? Is that they are making most of the money. Apparently SLP, the token has become, I had dinner with Gabby the other day. Gabby from YGG is amazing.
Yeah.
He said that SLP is so prevalent in the Philippines now that it's like, you'll see, I think he tweeted one out today. It's like Craigslist ads priced in SLP.
It's become, it's become a medium of exchange. It's actually literally become a local money. It's incredible. So what do you think is going to happen here? One of the quotes in that thread, you said, this trend continues as Web3 startups begin to eat into the margin of Web2 incumbents. The higher the take rate, the more vulnerable the incumbent, right? And so this applies to like Web2 companies. It also applies to the gaming industry. It also probably applies to the music industry. But like, so how does this shake out? Does Web3 go and start to disrupt all of these various industries?
I think so. I think it will. I think that the most vulnerable will be the ones that monetize the worst today. So I think music's a great example. And in fact, I had never in my career, I think, invested in a music startup. And I think I can say this. We haven't announced which ones, but we've invested in two crypto music related things in the last 2 months.
Wow.
And that's because, so the reason I never invested before, I had friends who did. So for example, I had a friend who started, if you remember Turntable FM.
I remember that,
but it was a really cool app that was kind of music avatar experience. Anyone can get up on stage and DJ and you'd listen to it in the background, just pay kind of a little community. And I saw him years later and he'd given up because the music labels just wouldn't, they just wouldn't give him the licensing. He tried to pay them. He tried to cut deals. They just don't want to. They're basically law firms at this point, and they don't want to do anything new or creative. They just want to kind of extract money from their catalog. And so, as a VC and an entrepreneur, you just sort of, you know what, this is Death Valley. Like you can't go there because they just won't. You just need the music rights, and they won't give them to you, and it's just not going to work. And of course, Spotify did well, and they were the one exception. But what's beautiful now is the musicians can go direct. So like when Blau did his drop, his NFT drop, and made $11 million, you don't need the labels or Spotify or anything else. It's just the musician and their fans. It's the Substack thing we were talking about earlier. And there's all sorts of interesting new ways. So I think the way it's going to shake out is the music will be free. There will not be people charging for it in the same way that games are free today. The games industry figured this out a long time ago. So in the games industry, the dominant model is what Fortnite does, what League of Legends does, right? The game is completely free. You can play every feature of the game for free. They charge they realize it's better to give that away. Let people mod it. Let them stream it. Let them do whatever they want. The internet is a giant copy machine. Let the internet do what it's good at. It's good at propagating cool stuff, right? Among other things. Let it do its thing on my game and then monetize something else. And in the case of those games, they monetize cosmetic goods, mostly virtual goods. I think it's the same thing's going to happen. I'm pretty sure it's going to happen with music. Music will just be free. Let it spread. Let it get remixed. Let it get modded. Do whatever you want. And I'm going to complement the adjacency, which is the adjacent layer of the stack, which is the ownership of the NFTs and all the kind of status flexing and behind the scenes access and a whole bunch of other kind of cool things that people will design around the music in the same way that that was the dominant model in gaming. And if you look, actually, I did that in one of the tweet storms. Gaming has consistently grown every year. Every time there's a new tech, gaming has grown. Gaming is a $140 billion industry. Music has shrunk and it's been flat and now it's like $20 billion. So it's a seventh of the size of gaming, which doesn't make any sense when you think about how popular it is and how much people love music. The reason it's been stuck there is there's been no innovation. And once the music industry is allowed to embrace new technology, as I think they may be about to be, they will grow along with gaming and they will embrace the same things. When Nintendo for a long time, Nintendo had a very kind of retro view of the internet, and they fought streaming for a very long time because they said that's illegal copyright infringement. And eventually they realized, it sounds funny, but it's like, hey, you got to pay to see Mario jump. You can't just get it for free. And so they fought it. And then eventually they realized, wait, we shouldn't fight it. It just makes our games more popular and we sell more games. Right. And I think people will realize that with all other forms of media, that it's not, the model is not to like create fake scarcity on this giant, meme propagation machine, i.e. the internet. The model is to let the internet do its thing and charge for something else that's scarce, like NFTs.
Yeah, this is so incredible because, of course, with the NFT space, non-fungible space, this is all net new functionality that like just wasn't previously possible. That's what this new token primitive provides. So let's get to maybe the fourth mental model here, which I think relates to everything we've talked about so far. And this is the idea of networks becoming economies. Yeah. And just like my teeing up of this is, I feel like in the Web 2 era, we really learned about the power of networks, right? This is like the social network era, okay? So we had mental models. Reid Hoffman talked about blitz scaling, right? We got to understand growth via Metcalfe's law, right? Sort of this network virality type of growth model. But now what you're talking about in this thread is we don't just have networks, we can actually upgrade those networks and turn them into economies. So networks become economies. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So I would start by saying that the internet is a network of networks. So on top of the internet, we have other networks such as Facebook, Twitter, every Discord server, every subreddit. There are millions of networks. And we've basically spent, this is a little bit to your point, you said we already have Web 2, we can build Web 3 on top of it, right? We spent the last 20 years, we, the world, building millions of networks. Airbnb's a network, Uber's a network, right? These are all networks. So they've got all these networks built out, and we're nodes in these networks, and maybe you've got your Twitter account, and you've got your followers, and you've got TikTok, and you've got YouTube, or whatever you have, Substack. But the only business model that we had layered on top of that, for the most part, were advertising, and with a few other exceptions. We now have a way to take those networks and let value flow through them freely. And that value is our tokens, right? And what that means is that instead of, it's the things we talked about before. The creator who has built this audience on Twitter and is used to only being able to make money by maybe tweeting out a link to, her show or Spotify account, can now let this thing that was previously an information network only, her Twitter following, become also a value network, right? Be also a network through which NFTs and tokens and other things can flow. So I think of it as, I think of a marketplace is a certain type of network where in addition to information flowing through it, there's also value flowing through it.
I think if the listener kind of uses their imagination, you can really start to feel the economy side of even the Web 2 platforms these days. Facebook and the way that it, information flows and energy flows through Facebook. Yeah. Well, what happens if all that information flow that is being routed through Facebook also has a value layer that can go along inside of it? And same thing with like Spotify, you see all of your friends, the music rises to the top. There can be value associated with these information networks that already exist.
Yeah, and you're right. You see some of it today. You'll see people on their Facebook account or on some other, hey, I'm tweeting out something I'm trying to sell, my old sofa, right? So people will use them somewhat as marketplaces, but it's not a native experience, right? You click on it and you got to go to another website and you got to put in your credit card and your social security number and all this like kind of legacy stuff. And it's not a closed loop and it's not. And so and as a result, the conversion rates are really low. And this is why the industry kind of settled on advertising, because advertising is digitally native, at least. Right, it's like the full closed loop. The advertiser comes on. There's an auction. It's targeted. The whole kind of money flow is done in a purely digital way, and so it just works a lot better than when you have these non-digitally native payment systems, which I consider the kind of the whole existing legacy payment system that way. Just the numbers don't end up working, and so you get very little value flowing through it as a result. There are exceptions. The exception I was going to say is like somebody who built their business on Instagram, you know, linking to their Shopify account. It's sort of an exception, but you know, the way Instagram's built is you will build up an organic audience, and then they'll start to throttle your reach. Right? You hear this all the time, and they do that deliberately so that they can get you to buy ads to get back to the reach you had. And so that's their very clever way of kind of increasing their take rate even on the organic side. So there is value through it, but it's also, to the extent, even if there is value, it's just the Web2 companies have gotten so good at extraction, either direct extraction through paid ads or indirect through throttling organic reach and forcing you to get paid ads to get back to that audience, that, you know, yeah. So, I mean, it's a complicated nuanced topic, and I, you know, was trying to distill it into a tweet storm, but there's a lot of aspects to it.
You know, what's super striking to me is like when you're thinking about you think about economies very differently than networks, right? Networks, you might think about you know, revenue, for example, but like economies, like the Axie economy, you think in different metrics. You think in maybe GDP, right? How many people am I employing this economy? And I think that's a paradigm shift. Yeah. I think another paradigm shift is in your tweet thread. You talked about the way this would develop.
Yeah.
And there's two kind of analogies that jumped out. This idea of a real world bazaar rather than maybe like a department store is kind of the example. Or idea that this would develop more like a city rather than a theme park. And why do you think that these networks, I suppose, these economic networks will be structured in those ways? They'll start to resemble things that are a bit more, I guess, organic, bottom-up, bazaar-like, rather than cathedral-like.
No, that's a great, and I was thinking of the cathedral and the bazaar, if you're familiar with that. I'm a big fan of open source and that culture, and have tracked it for a long time. And that was, of course, it was Eric Raymond's essay about the difference between kind of the open source bottoms-up method and the top-down method. I think, by the way, there are places in life where you want top-down. So, for example, probably you needed a company like Apple to build the iPhone. It's very hard for a community to come together and do, you know, that type of high capex factories, supply chains, all these other kinds of things. In software, and I think particularly the internet, I believe the bottoms up approach is going to lead to a much richer, more interesting, more diverse, and more equitable internet. And the analogy I would use is to like New York City versus Disneyland or something, right? So Disneyland is a command centralized economy, and New York City is much more kind of organically developed. And so in New York, you think about, there's a great, some crypto people like Jane Jacobs. She's a just amazing author who wrote about kind of the life of cities, and has this amazing first chapter in this book where she's talking about just a city block and all the different things you have on a healthy block. And a healthy block, you have a sidewalk, you have restaurants, you have residences, you have barber shops. She has this concept that like you feel like it's a better block when there's more eyes on the street, when you feel like you feel safe to walk if you're a tourist, and like tourists instantly know that feels like a good block. And then more people come, and then more people come and they want to walk on the block, and then more restaurants open up and more barbershops open up and the real estate values go up. Right. And it's this kind of network effect of the city block. It was a really beautiful passage, because that's also like, that's a microcosm of the broader city, right? The broader city, that's what you do to create a healthy city. But the interesting thing she talked about, it was this, first of all, it's a bottoms up process, right? There wasn't somebody who was like the commissioner saying we need more eyes on that street, right? There are commissioners in there, but what they do is they say, okay, we need some public space here. You know, the sidewalk is public. This part is private. And this part has a park. And then you let the bottoms up kind of this ecosystem develop. And in a healthy city, you have different things. You have private businesses and you have public resources. If it weren't for the public sidewalk, the restaurant, if the sidewalk were owned by some company, the restaurant wouldn't feel comfortable opening their business behind that sidewalk, knowing someone could charge a toll or something, right? You need that to be public. In the same way, you need the open protocols to be public, to have the business build on top of it. Right. And so you want the two. And if everything was privately controlled, it would end up being like Disneyland and sterile and boring. If everything was publicly controlled, I don't think you'd have the kind of diverse innovation that entrepreneurs bring. So there's a balance. And I believe the internet has fallen out of balance. And it's now the sort of four Disneylands. And we need to bring it back. Ethereum, on the other hand, is a great example where, to me, it feels like a city. It's a very kind of beautiful community. The people are building interesting things on top, many different layers. A lot of the blockchain world is like that. Ethereum is probably the most, the healthiest.
By the way, if you're going to pick a place to live, you got to actually live your life. You'd rather live in a real city than in Disneyland. I mean,
I'm in New York right now, and I'm here for a reason, which is I love New York, and like it's endlessly. By the way, one thing I love in New York is I love walking around the streets. It's just like I like seeing people. I like seeing stuff. I like seeing, and I feel like that. And I used to like the internet in the same way. It was like, let me just go. You know, this used to be this phrase, surf the web, right? It sounds kind of silly now or something, but like it was called that because you'd sort of like bounce around and find all this weird stuff.
Rabbit holes.
Yahoo back then had everywhere. They had cool. It's great now. Like on my Twitter mentions, it's all like crazy avatars. I'm like, finally the internet's like interesting and weird again. Like all these
totally anons. Way more fun.
It's just like fun and interesting again too. I mean, like that's not like a scientific statement, obviously, but just my anecdotal experience is just like, I actually like enjoy going on the internet and seeing like weird, interesting stuff again in a way I didn't, in the same way that I do when I walk around New York. And I don't go to Disneyland. I don't want to go to Disneyland.
The vibe is cool once again. Chris, I want to pull out two previous aspects from other mental models and bring them into this whole networks become economies conversations. Two things that you said is that tokens inside of a user's inventory pushes power towards the user. And for me, the user is the person, you know, walking around the streets with a bunch of tokens in their pockets and a bunch of businesses clamoring to get their hands on some of the user's tokens. So I want to put that frame of reference into your mind. But also this whole concept of bazaars, not department stores, and take rates that aren't top-down determined. There's an interaction there behind all these companies that are lining the streets of this city that have this free market capitalism trying to get the tokens that the users, the pedestrians, are walking around that they have contained. So how, when this economy actually blossoms and we have power and the control of the user, how do you think that develops like going forward?
So are the businesses different than the businesses today? Or
So we have all these businesses, then we have all these users that have their own property rights in these networks. And now we have these, you know, instead of Web 2 companies that have top-down controls as to what the prices should be, we have these infinite economies that can create any sort of business mechanism unleashed from the control of these Web 2 platforms. When it comes to just innovation, business development, and also consumer protections, how do you think all these dynamics kind of play into one another?
That's a good question. So
it's very, very open-ended. So, well, look, so go ahead and take with that what you will.
Yeah, so I think ideally we end up with a world where the user has significantly more power than today because the switching costs are much lower. The switching costs of going to from OpenSea to whatever, some other competitor, they're much lower because you can take your wallet and your identity with you versus Twitter where you can, you're stuck there, right? And so I think that we're going to see a massive shift kind of towards the edges of the network. Vitalik has his great quote, which is, you know, all of so many technology innovations shift power to the center, including, I think, AI. AI is going to make kind of big incumbent companies more powerful, and workers at the edges kind of disenfranchise. Blockchains are the opposite. They hollow out the middle and they push stuff out to the outside, right? So, you know, your show is not called New Bank, it's called Bankless, right? Like you're getting rid of the bank and you still get the functionality of a bank, but the users are, you know, now have control and power, right? But, and you don't have that thing in the middle with taking stuff. So I hope that's number one. I hope that the other thing, and this is not obvious. We have work to do. I hope it's all interoperable, right? I hope these are not islands, these economies. And I think this is, people talk about the metaverse and, you know, Facebook working on their version of it. And I think to me, probably the big question, if, you know, when this kind of metaverse develops, which I sort of think of as this interconnected virtual world where you work and you play, and maybe there's three-dimensional VR interfaces and who knows what. Is it controlled by IOI, you know, the Ready Player One company, and they have everything? Or is it more like the web where there's just anyone can add on another world or room and they all interoperate and the powers and the users, you know? And that's a big open question. I think that we're trending in the right way, but, you know, it's still early. In terms of like consumer protections and things, I mean, I think, I don't know if you want to talk about kind of regulatory stuff, but I think we have very extensive consumer protection, commodities laws, a whole bunch of other things in this, you know, in the US. And most of the investing we do is in the US, and we'd like to see most of this innovation happen in the US, and companies pay taxes and hire people and everything else.
I was mainly referring to consumer protections by free market competition, as in if somebody's gouging the consumer.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a big thing. I think there's two ways to control kind of big companies that act in predatory ways. One is to try to regulate them directly through monopoly law and things like that, which I think we're about to see some of that happen. I don't think that will work very well. If you sliced up Facebook into four different social networks or three different or however many it is, I don't think that's going to change the power dynamics. I think smarter in a regulation, like forcing them to externalize the network to really let you leave the network and take your followers with you and support open protocols, maybe could work. I don't know. I don't see it headed that way. The other way to control these companies is to provide competition and to provide a new model where the user has power and has lower switching costs. And don't let it happen again that users are locked in, that they're locked in and that they're, you know, that they're dependent on these intermediaries. And that's obviously what we're trying to work towards.
Do you know what I feel like has been the common thread throughout all these mental models and all this discussion is the threat of property rights, self-sovereign property rights. What's super interesting to me is like, of course, if we live in this world of four Disneylands on the internet, like, of course we can't get something organic like a New York City out of it. Why? Yeah. I mean, because I can't go set up a marketplace in Disneyland. I don't own it. Yeah. If I go to Disneyland, I'm just renting the space and it's all Disneyland material. It's like, so I'm not going to set up a shop. I'm not going to build my home. I'm not going to build any property on Disneyland because I don't own it. I don't have property rights. That it appears to me is the common thread through this whole thing is like somehow in this Web3 experience that we've just created, we've unleashed property rights.
That's exactly right. And it's very interesting. It's a kind of mind bending thing to imagine, but imagine we lived in the real world, forget about the internet. And we had no concept of property rights. Everything was rented from four, you know, big and large IOI, pick your four dystopian companies. And then one day somebody came along and, you know, threw the sledgehammer through the Apple ad in 1984 and we had property rights, you know, at the beginning, and you suddenly could own something. And at the beginning, you would probably have some of the behavior we're seeing now, like in the NFT world, like of speculation and sort of degens and all this other stuff, right? Oh my God, I can own something. Oh, well, I want to own that. You want to own that. Like I own the better thing or something. You know, it could be kind of a little bit, we're in that phase now, right? Where it's like,
It's very reflexive.
Yeah, it's very reflexive. You know, there's some silliness going on, as there always is. But that's not lose sight of the big picture, which is like, yes, we just took the most important invention of the 20th/21st century, the internet, and added property rights to it. Right? It's a big deal. And it's going to take a long time to really kind of play out. And there will be, you know, there will be bad ideas, there'll be abuses. But overall, I think it's going to be a fantastically positive development.
It is a big deal. And David and I have argued that it's actually fundamental if we're going to create something like the metaverse, which again, no one wants a Disneyland version of the metaverse, which is just like Facebook or one conglomerate controlling, right?
There's a risk of it. There's a real risk
but
of it.
Like, it's gonna be, if we have property rights, then maybe we won't fall prey to that. I want to end with maybe the, we'll talk about A16Z as well, but like the last mental model to cover is maybe this idea that a lot of people get tripped up on, I think is one of your core mental models, where they just dismiss crypto far too early. It's just a toy mental model or trap, let's say, that they fall into. So you wrote this tweet thread I thought was brilliant, and it really covers what people say about a new technology. And I think people are still saying this about crypto right now. When it's janky, when the UX sucks, when it's all brand new, they say three things. Number one, they say it's just a toy. Number two, they say it's too expensive. And number three, they say it doesn't solve any real problem. So can you talk about those traps and why do people always fall into them?
Yeah, it's a great question. So and I think each is probably a different pattern and it depends on the technology. So as an example, it's too expensive tends to apply to hardware. And so, you know, Tesla would be an obvious example where it's just simply the nature of hardware. I've been involved with a few hardware companies is when you're at subscale, you just pay a lot more for supplies and assembly and everything else. And so as you sell more units, the price can drop dramatically. I mean, you go to the Best Buy now and you look at the TVs, it's incredible, right? The cost of TVs and how good they've gotten is a good example. The Tesla car.
What do you think about block space, though? Do you think that's an example? Like some people are like, gas fees are too high.
Yes, for sure. We're going to see a lot of, we can talk about that more, but I think we're going to see a lot of, you know, the Optimism, Arbitrum, Polygon, Phantom, other L1s. That said, I think that I would predict that block space is going to be that demand is going to outstrip supply for a very long time. I think the prices, the more supply coming on will be great and will moderate it. But I think block space is the best product to be selling in the 2020s. It's like, it's a great product.
People forget it's a product. People forget that that's why blockchains exist.
You will see us do a lot of block space investment. I believe people will tell you, I believe block space is a good business in the 2020s. So we will be investing a lot. But look, obviously we want the supply to grow and we want the price to go down. We want this to be an accessible technology. It's not accessible right now, some of the gas fees. So, you know, we want to be inclusive, but I think it'll probably also be a thing where you pay different levels for different levels of security. Maybe there's other L1s where, you know, you're paying lower prices and then you say, hey, I got a lot here. I want to take it over to Ethereum, which is sort of Ethereum L1 is sort of the premium thing. Anyway, so that's stuff that's too expensive. Then there's stuff that starts out at like toys. This is really Clay Christensen. So he has a great book called Innovator's Dilemma, where he talks about this common pattern where a new technology will come out and it will just be kind of crappy, like the PC early on. The PC, when it first came out, and I guess it was the late 70s, but like to say, I think the Apple II was like 83 or something. You know, it had very few apps, a couple of games. I don't even think they had a word processor then. And the device, it was like you had to assemble it and just the whole, it was kind of a ridiculous product, yet it sold like crazy. It was $5,000 in today's dollars when it came out.
Wow.
Incredibly, also expensive and a toy, both, the double whammy. But what happened is, you know, first Moore's Law, right? Just all the hardware got exponentially better. So they were riding Moore's Law and they were riding another exponential growth curve, which is application developers came on and they invented the spreadsheet and the word processor and desktop publishing and games and just all the things that happened, right? And all of a sudden buying an Apple II in 1987 was a very, very different value proposition than buying one in 1983. And so, you know, so that's what things that look like toy. I think, you know, Skype, when Skype first came out, it was this thing that you had to have a microphone. People didn't have mics built into the PCs back then. And it was janky and drop calls, but it was free and you could call your family in India and talk for free. Right. So it's sort of amazing, but you go back and read that kind of stuff around it. The telephone is the most canonical example. So when the telephone came out, was Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone. At the time, the telegraph business was incumbent business, and the telegraph business, basically they served the railroad. So a railroad would come, railroads were the enterprise, they're enterprise customers of that era. They paid a lot of money and they said, we want to say, hey, we have this much lumber at this depot, send that over telegraph over here and we'll pay you a lot of money to do it because it helps us manage our inventory. Telephone comes along. It can only go like 500 feet. Sounds like crap. And like, why would you want voice when you want to send lumber prices? So Western Union, because they were thinking like, this is a clever thing with Clay Christensen's framework. He's not saying these managers are idiots. He's saying the opposite. They're very smart. They go, they talk to their customers. At that time, the customers were the railroads. They asked them what they want. And they said, we don't want voice. This short distance voice. We want to know how much lumber to send. Right. And so, but what they underestimated was, first of all, the phone got much, much better very, very quickly, right? And you could go long distances and everything else. The quality got better. And then, you know, app developers, quote unquote, people came along and said, hey, I want to talk to somebody. I want to, like, the consumer market opened up. It was a business market before that. It suddenly was consumer. And so it came from below. And so Western Union very famously passed on all the patents. They could have bought the patents for very cheaply of the phone. They did said it had no value, and they passed on it. That's probably the most famous kind of example of that pattern. I think we're seeing it now to some extent also in crypto, where, you know, you have these like Web3, you know, MetaMask, everything else. And it's, you know, if you're a Google, Facebook product manager and you're used to these ultra slick mobile experiences, two clicks, you know, it looks janky. What is this? It's developed. I mean, actually, I would argue that that's an amazingly positive signal for us. The fact that it is so janky and yet there's 10 million people, you know, active users of MetaMask.
Totally agree. Totally.
People are sort of clamoring, you know, willing to go through all the pain to get it. But I think that's happening to some extent here. And then, yeah, the last of the three kind of mistakes we'll make about technology is, what problem does it solve? And I think the what problem does it solve is a very, it's just a very, to think that a new technology needs to immediately solve a problem. I mean, what problem did Facebook solve at first? They're creating a giant social group. They didn't solve a problem. It created a new set of behaviors and opportunities. Computers are the most obvious example. Like, no computer by itself solves any problem. The computer creates a design canvas upon which entrepreneurs and developers can create applications, which then can sometimes solve problems. Although, did the spreadsheet solve a problem? Kind of. But at the time, people didn't really have, it was more that they just enabled them to do kind of more advanced business calculations, right? Like the businesses were running perfectly fine before that. And they were doing accounting before that, long before that. So the computer unlocked a new design space, but it's like a multi-step process, right? Not all innovation is sort of a direct short line. The thing that bugs me about what problems it solves, it assumes innovation is just like one direct, simple thing, right? As opposed to a multi-step kind of community process, which the biggest things follow these kind of much more kind of circuitous routes, I would argue. So yeah, that tweet storm was just meant to show that, I've made all these mistakes myself. I'm not saying this to say that I think they're all very natural mistakes. And I've made them myself. I think I've learned over time, having gotten, my ass kicked a bunch of times on bad decisions and investing in other things like that, that I take a closer look. Like, hey, when I say it's a toy, or hey, it's too expensive, like, what's the price curve? And it's too expensive. Hey, it's a toy. What's the improvement curve? The toy will get better. Too expensive. What's the price curve? Will it go down? It doesn't solve a problem. Okay, but does it inspire other people to build things on top of it that in turn could solve problems? So ask that next question is kind of my takeaway. That's what I've learned. Dig deeper, ask the next question, and don't kind of write things off too soon.
This is one of my favorite mental models of all time because it applies just to every new technology. Yeah. So you'll use it in crypto, but then you'll use it in every subclass of crypto, right? Whether it's crypto gaming, whether it's anything in crypto, you'll continue to use it. And people say the same thing, like NFTs, DeFi, it's just like a toy. It's toy finance.
Yeah.
And they say it's too expensive. They ask you what problems it solves, and they don't realize that this is just an unlock for developers and others in the ecosystem to build new things. Chris, I think we're almost about time. Yeah. Do you have a few more minutes?
Yeah, I can go a few more minutes.
Okay, cool. Let's maybe end by talking about, A16. So as I said, it's been about 10 years since we last spoke, at least in the crypto timeline, right? How's 2021 playing out? Is it playing out the way you expected? Like, what's changed in the world of A16Z? Yeah. I know you guys raised big fund. Has the crypto fund eaten any of the other groups within A16? Yeah. So what's happening there?
Yeah, I think that I think my sense is throughout the sort of venture world that people are taking Web3 crypto more seriously. There was, I've seen our news articles that some of our competitors, for example, who have previously shunned crypto have now gotten religion. So that's good. I think that's good. We welcome competition. And also, frankly, like I always knew the path to victory, of course, would involve more people participating in this. And that includes both entrepreneurs and investors. So that's good. There's definitely been more interest throughout our firm. I think, particularly on fintech, consumer and gaming. I think NFTs, I think that the kind of evolution I think of it is, so we had the kind of early history, Bitcoin, Ethereum, and then we had a lot of infrastructure stuff. A lot of our investments in 2017, 18 were infrastructure. And then DeFi, of course, right? We're investors in Uniswap and Compound and Maker and all of that. And that was great too. But, DeFi, finance is just a narrower set of, there's a smaller set of people that are interested in finance versus NFTs, which is and gaming, which is kind of all of culture. By the way, I think they're all going to reinforce each other. I think of the way that we get DeFi to the next level is by bringing 100 million people in through gaming and NFTs. And those people are going to naturally want to save their money in DeFi. And so I think they're all kind of closely connected and reinforcing. But I do think that when you sort of talk to an average person, walking down the street in New York City, something like an NFT or a game is kind of more accessible to them. And so that's affected the venture world for sure. Yeah, we raised a new fund. We've hired a bunch of people. It's become a meme on Twitter. We actually only have, I think we have 30 or so full-time people on the crypto team. So it is larger. The meme's a little overblown maybe, but...
What's the meme? I'm curious. I haven't seen this.
Oh, it's like everyone's joking they joined A16Z.
I'm going to tweet that out right after this recording.
we had a week, I think, where we hired someone every day, and then I think it sort of turned into a meme. It was funny. I think we're about 30-some. And then we have about 10 or so advisors and others. So there's, I have to go count it up exactly. But it's a great team. We really try to kind of cover different practice areas, as I mentioned before, of NFTs, gaming, DeFi. Just last week we announced Element Finance, which is a DeFi protocol. And so we're still trying to, be very active. We're doing, like I mentioned before, a bunch of infrastructure stuff. I think we've got to continue to kind of invest at all layers. So And I think, you know, as I mentioned before, like I think ZK stuff, for example, might be a really interesting kind of future infrastructure area.
Your partner came on, Ariana Simpson. We talked about this a little bit earlier in the show, and she gave a take that I wanted to see if you agree with or not. She said that all crypto funds will just become funds, and all non-crypto funds are just going to turn into crypto funds eventually. Kind of in the same way that once upon a time we had internet funds, and now all of a sudden we just have like what is now the S&P 500.
I think that's right.
How do you feel about that
I
take?
I think that's right. Well, I think, look, I think the way I think about it is that if we're right, if I think the three of us probably agree on this, if we're right that future internet products are created in the Web3 mold and they and the value accrual happens through tokens, then the rest of the world is going to want to they're going to want to follow that. They're going to want to follow where that value on the internet is created. And if it's, I believe most of the value in the future of the internet will be created through tokens. And I think a corollary to that would be most financial institutions interested in internet value creation will want to buy tokens. And so I think it will spread not only from the venture side, but I think that that's how also the, you know, the broader institutional side, the banks and the hedge funds and all sorts of other folks like that. So yeah, I mean, look, I think it'll be much slower to affect enterprise software. And I mean, enterprise software, I think it's like 15% of enterprises use SaaS software today and the rest is still on-premise. So it's just a slower moving area. We have a bio fund. I think that's, you know, I think they actually did do one crypto bio thing. It's kind of a folding at home incentivized mining thing. It's cool. But I think, you know, some of that stuff will be kind of slower. But I think in the kind of mainstream consumer world, I think it's going to all blend together. I agree with Ariana.
So apart with A16Z, then, like, what's changed, do you think, from a regulatory landscape perspective? I know A16Z has been involved, like you guys put out a policy agenda a couple weeks ago, which, like, I do feel like our lawmakers and those in government, at least in the U.S., they do need some guidance on this, because I haven't seen much coherence and like a framework coming out of that area. But like, what's changed, do you think, in the past year or so since we talked?
Well, I mean, the big thing is the administration change, and this administration seems to be less friendly to crypto and blockchain stuff. You know, I think there's, the way I kind of think about this is there's many, many kind of layers to this. There's specific kind of, you know, legal and regulatory kind of tactical level stuff. And we have now at A16Z Crypto, 10 people who work on that. Like, we very heavily invest in that area. You know, the first thing we do when we make an investment is we help them find a general counsel and kind of help them with legal stuff. So there's that layer. And then I think there's another layer, which is kind of the broader, I think the comms, let's call it the comms layer or something, which is explaining this to the world. Because I think a lot of these regulatory kinds of questions are tied up with this other question, which is, you know, I think a lot of people don't believe that there's positive societal benefit in crypto. They see this idea that it's about making money and tech bros, and you know, a lot, and that's due to a lot of the coverage, which I don't think was fair coverage. I don't think it's accurate. It's not my experience at all in the space. I doubt it's your experience, but that's the impression people have. And you know, it's kind of number go up culture, not innovation culture. I believe it's innovation culture. I believe, as the things we talked about today, that this will provide, for example, a new and important way for creators to monetize on the internet. And I think, you know, I think when we can show, I think it's very important that we show that, because it's one thing for me to sit here on a podcast and say that. It's another thing if we can go and point to 20 musicians or 1,000 musicians or ideally 1,000,000 musicians whose lives have been changed. So I see that as fundamentally the key question here. Is it's incumbent to, I think we need to help, we need to explain things better. I try to do my part with these Twitter threads and then podcasts and things like that. You guys do a big part of it. And so as a community, we need to just explain, I think, these concepts better and why it's good for society to have this technology. And then I think we need to prove it. We need to prove it by having examples to point to where people are being helped. Right. And so that's what I'm very focused on from that. You know, I think, look, ultimately, there were regulatory questions around ride sharing. There were regulatory questions around Airbnb. I think what ultimately convinced people that there should be regulation, of course, but there should be regulation that allows those companies to exist, is they saw the value. They saw the value as a rider. And, you know, you can click a button, ride an Uber. They saw the value. They knew a driver who made a living that way. And so that's the ultimate path to acceptance of technology, is to prove to the world it has societal value. And that we have to do that. We, the community, I think. And we need to do it. You know, I think the sooner the better. I think it's something that needs to happen in the next probably year or two. And I think the good news is I think it's happening very rapidly.
Well said. I mean, as we've always said on Bankless, this is a battle for hearts and minds. We have to build it. Like, we have to prove the utility, yeah. And they'll come after this. Chris, this has been a fantastic discussion. Thanks so much for joining us. I guess maybe...
Yeah, no, thank you both. Thank you both for having me and all the work you do.
Last question for you, too, is like, leave us with one thing. What do you think people should be ready for in 2022? Do you think this is, you know, do you think we're headed for another bear market? Do you think we're, you know, going to continue to explode up? Do you have like any ideas to leave us with?
I would say, so Eddie and I wrote this blog post about this, if folks are interested, but I think there's a very important distinction to make is between a product winter and financial winter. The prices could go down 90%. They could go, who knows? I have no idea. I don't even try to predict this, frankly.
They've done it before. Yeah,
and I have no idea. And I would act as if that were the case. If you know, I don't give financial advice. Disclosure, this is not financial advice, but if I did, I would say like act as if everything's going to go down 90%. There's a different, I think much more important cycle is the product cycle. Okay. And these are kind of independent. And on the product cycle, I'm very, very bullish because I see the products in the pipeline. And it's two things. I see the products in the pipeline and there's a lot of really good people entering. Like the level has gone way, way up of entrepreneurs, the kind of quality, number one. And number two, because so much infrastructure is built out, the kind of clock speed now is much, much faster. You know, like people on Twitter, they're like, you know, NFTs are over and they're boring. And then 3 days later, a great new project launches, right? And you're going to see that like every week now. And I remember 2019, there was a financial winter in crypto. You guys were there. But the thing that bugged me was not that. It was the product winter. I remember there were just so few product launches.
It's true.
Right? There's like a product launch every 3 days now. That I don't think is stopping. Like, I think that would take a lot to stop. And that's the really important one, I think. The other one, look, the other stuff will go up and down and who knows. And, you know, global macroeconomics, inflation, I have no idea. That's not my job. Like, I don't try to predict that. But the product cycle, I do try to predict. And the product cycle, I've never felt better. I think the quality of people coming in, I get an email. I said this in a tweet the other day, and it's true. I get an email like a day from a very high quality entrepreneur saying, I went down the rabbit hole and I used to think you were crazy, Chris. And now I'm like, oh my God, this is like the greatest thing ever. This happens a lot. And I think a lot of those people will stay, you know, regardless of prices.
We have talked a lot in the crypto space about the super cycle. Maybe this is the cycle where crypto prices just go up twice without going down. TBD on whether that's even financially possible or not. Sometimes it's just too hard to make that much money that quickly. But it sounds like what you're saying, Chris, is that you definitely believe in the super cycle in terms of product development.
Yeah, I think the product cycle is a key thing. I think that if you go back, I wrote a blog post about, actually, this may be a good tweet storm, but I wrote a blog post about this once where I analyzed it kind of, when companies were founded, when iconic companies were founded in correlation to NASDAQ, and it's just uncorrelated.
Wow.
It's just, yeah, so it's just like, that'd be actually a good tweet storm, I should do that, but it's just not correlated. And so like there will be, I guarantee you. So what keeps me up at night is like, look at my job is like, I want to make sure we have the next OpenSea, the next Uniswap. We have like, what will it be? And how do we stay close to what I try to do is I don't look at the prices. I stay close to the entrepreneurs. I'm like, where is the energy moving? You know, where is like the world spirit moving? What's the new area? And how do we kind of make sure we're in there? And if we do that, I think this is generally true in innovative markets. If you follow that energy, like, and you have a long-term perspective, I think it generally works out.
Super cool. Well, folks, we're going to have to leave it here. Chris, it has been an absolute pleasure. We've covered so much. 5 mental models for you and got an update on A16Z, regulatory environment. You left us with some words of wisdom. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you both. Thank you both for having me and for all the great work you do for the community.
Absolutely. Wouldn't be anywhere else. Everything else is boring once you see crypto, as we discussed earlier. Action items for you guys. I know Bankless listeners are right along with us in feeling that as well. We'll throw up some links to the 5 mental models we discussed. Those will be linked in the show notes. Also, of course, if you like this episode, if you like Bankless, don't forget to do something about it. Like the podcast, subscribe, 5-star reviews on Apple iTunes. Pick one. This is not the scalability trilemma. You can pick more than 2. You can do all 3 at once if you'd like. Of course, risks and disclaimers. None of this has been financial advice. ETH is risky. DeFi is risky. So are NFTs. This entire Web3 thing we're embarking on is risky. You could lose what you put in, but we are headed west. This is the frontier. It's not for everyone, but thanks for joining us on the Bankless Journey.